well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. I know, I might not look like him. I don't have a hat on, but and what the heck is this? But sitting in for Larry O'Connor on O'Connor and Company today, and there's a dress code if you're hosting O'Connor and Company. You need the coat and tie. And I thought, okay, well, I'll wear one. And then I completely forgot to bring a hat over to my office and sat down to tape today's Bearing Arms, Cam and Company, and thought, well, I guess we're going hatless. Because you just can't, you know, there was a time back in my 30s when I was doing Cam and Company for NRA News. I would wear the shirt and tie and the ball cap. I'm not sure if I could get away with it even back then, but I did. Definitely can't get away with it these days. So there you go. Good news is the head is freshly waxed. The lights aren't too bright in here. I don't think you'll get any blind spots from looking at the noggin. Very pleased to have with us on the program today, Sarah Joy Albrecht from Hold My Guns. There is some really, really good news out of Ohio in terms of voluntary safe storage. We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about a refresh for the Hold My Guns website, some new branding, some new imagery, but the mission is still the same. You know, Sarah Joy is one of my favorite people. Voluntary offsite storage is one of the things that I am pretty passionate about in terms of serving as an alternative. You know, sometimes gun control activists will say, we always don't have any answers. All you do is say no. Yeah, I'm going to say no to stuff that infringes on my right to keep and bear arms. But it's not true that that there are no answers to things like suicide, you know, coming from gun owners. You've got Walk the Talk America. You've got Hold My Guns. When it comes to addressing violent crime without putting more gun laws in place, there are all kinds of efforts underway. But voluntary offsite storage really is important. And not just, as you'll hear from Sarah Joy, not just in terms of preventing suicide, but in terms of preventing theft of firearms, in terms of helping individuals who are, you know, going through a deployment, even going through a divorce. These services can be life-saving, but they can also be life-enhancing. And that's one of the reasons why I think these programs are so important. And I'm so thrilled to see the success in the Ohio legislature. I think we have a way to go in Illinois, but in the Ohio legislature dealing with voluntary offsite storage. Anyway, great conversation with Sarah Joy Albrecht. I really appreciate her joining me on the program. Take a look and a listen. Sarah, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's really good to see you again.
Cam, it's so good to see you as well. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And congratulations on the rebrand of Hold My Guns. We're going to talk about that in a second. But, you know, it is in this day and age, it is so hard to see bipartisan support for anything. We just had a bill pass in Ohio, and I know that you testified in support of this. I believe the vote was unanimous in the House and the Senate.
Yes.
For this voluntary offsite storage bill. That is amazing. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. I really put my heart into it. And I was able to go to Ohio with my daughter, who is 19. And so it was just a great moment to share with her. And I testified about voluntary firearm storage and also educated the legislators there that we do not need solutions that infringe on rights, and that voluntary firearm storage is something that even supports DC versus Heller 2008, which talks about firearm storage and requirements for that, and that a person should have access to their firearms. And so I was very clear that if something is voluntary and it is in alignment with how that gun owner wants to care for their firearms, this is a solution that will work, and we want to see more things like that. And to your point, it was unanimous. That vote was unanimous. And so to be in the room and answering questions, and that footage, I think, is online if you want to see that hearing. And, you know, just to be able to answer questions from legislators who were both Democrats and Republicans in that room, and to be able to satisfy their questions about it was just exciting. And that to me shows that that this is a solution that is a viable option for legislators. They can say This is something that my constituents want, and we don't want to have more gun control. We want to instead encourage people to make responsible and life-affirming choices. So that was, it was wonderful. Thank you for mentioning that.
Absolutely. And, you know, you've got bills in Kansas, Oklahoma that I think are aimed at doing the same thing. So it seems like the legislatures around the country are starting to catch up to the activism that you've been doing for years.
Yes. And that to me has been very important. I pioneered voluntary firearm storage back in 2018 when we had lost a friend to suicide. And I realized we need to have a solution that is one that gun owners can use at their discretion, that's voluntary, and that's from within our own firearms community. And that mattered to me as a range safety officer and as a mom of five who we all did shooting sports for a really long time. And so as someone from our own community, I wanted a solution that respected rights. But with that responsibility of being a pioneer, it's also important to be part of the advocacy and outreach. And I wanted to make sure that it's always with the focus of preserving rights. And so that next step of really maturing the message of Hold My Guns is now we've been established in the firearms community, but is to really share with the world that there are solutions that are available that respect rights and that meet the needs of gun owners. So that has been in the past year or so, my focus is to really preserving the work that we've done and making sure that it is more of the type of tool that if you use that analogy, it's a tool that people would reach for as opposed to pushing things like red flag laws. But the reality is that if those policymakers don't know about Hold My Guns and they don't realize that there are other solutions out there, then they kind of feel like we have some concerns and we're trying to find a solution here, and they were unaware of anything else. And so that's really been my heart, is to now that it's established in our community, to educate the rest of the public. And to your point, we're seeing that change, and it's really exciting and something that just made my heart sing when I was in Ohio. There were other organizations there also sharing support for the bill. It was House Bill or Senate Bill 273. And, you know, just to be standing there and thinking, oh my goodness, like this, I have just goosebumps just thinking about it right now, Cam. Like, this is from the work that I did. Like, we would not be here unless I started this, for, you know, back in 2018. And so I wasn't quite teary-eyed, but it just really just spoke to my heart that this is the fruit that we've been working so hard for, and it really is making a difference. And then hearing stories from people testifying how it's making a difference in their community and how they want to make sure that gun shops are protected from liability if they're going to be providing this service. So it's just beautiful to see how this is flourishing. And it motivates me to want to just help grow the mission of Hold My Guns. And so that's why we decided to do a refresh, to really reflect the maturity of the brand and to encourage growth and equip people to be able to share the mission.
So if it's been a minute for us, for folks who have gone to holdmyguns.org, what will they find if they go to the website now?
So we, in partnership with Page 50 Media, which is a fantastic liberty-minded media company, we decided to do a brand refresh. And some of the things that people will notice right away, if you're familiar with the old logo, we used to have a circle logo that had open hands and there was a firearm in it. It's actually modeled after my husband's hands for the initial concept, and he was holding his Glock 19. But we also had colors in the logo, teal and purple, as well as green, which are mental health colors. And we noticed just over time, although our origin story was about suicide prevention, that a number of clients of our FFLs actually don't use it for mental health reasons at all. They use it for things like during deployment. We had a customer have a house fire and they needed a place to store their firearms while their home was being renovated. There was another gentleman who shared that he was in the middle of a custody battle, and by telling at the custody hearing, was able to tell the judge, my firearms are being safely stored. I am taking this very seriously, and the how volatile this situation is. And he was awarded joint custody, and actually, after that hearing, he's now co-parenting with his ex in a really beautiful way. He stayed in touch. So it just helped to take the pressure off the moment and de-escalate the situation. And it's been very good for him and his daughter and his ex-wife. So we're hearing a lot of stories like that. And so it was very important to me to reflect that in our logo. And so we've moved away from mental health colors, although we definitely mentioned suicide prevention on our new website and it's sprinkled throughout our brochures. We wanted to make sure that it wasn't stigmatizing people, that when they saw the logo at a gun shop or online or wherever, that it would only be associated with mental health. And we really wanted it to be something that was more ubiquitous with working with gun shops. This is a service that they can offer, and it's normalized. It's not, there's not a stigma of, are people going to assume that I'm using the service for mental health? And so again, although it's our origin story and it's really suicide prevention is always our heart, I really wanted to make it something that people just would think about for everyday purposes.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to be a big change that people see that logo. We went with a bronze shield, and it has a little bit, there's an abstract firearm in it. I don't know if you've noticed that, Cam, but there's one that's kind of like a negative space. And then there's also a positive space. So there's actually two firearms hidden in there, and it kind of symbolizes a voluntary exchange of a firearm. It's also enshrined by that shield, which is a symbol of strength and security. But something else I love about a shield is that in battle, you can build a shield wall and be shoulder to shoulder with others who are fighting right alongside of you. And to me, that's something that is beautiful about our firearms community, is that we do a lot of things shoulder to shoulder. We care about each other. The firearms community is a protective factor. And so just being able to link up and have our shields next to each other and say, we are moving forward together, that's something that really mattered to me. We also updated a word on our logo. It's really subtle, but we changed the word freedom to liberty. And to me, liberty is something that historically is a word that describes what it means to be advocating for the preservation of rights. And so, especially with the work that I've been doing in the past year, advocating for those rights, I wanted to reflect that in our logo as well.
That is a lot of change. And I wanted to something that you talked about in terms of removing the colors that are associated with mental health, and how you mm-hmm. don't want Hold My Guns to have that stigma of only suicide prevention, right? Because from the very first time I talked to you about this, you mentioned, you know, this is for people who are going out of town for a couple of weeks and don't want to leave their guns unattended as much as it is for somebody who is, you know, concerned about a crisis in their home. When somebody goes to an FFL that has this voluntary offsite storage in place, are they even going to be asked why they need to use that service? Or is it just, okay, yeah, here's the form you got to fill out. Here's how this works.
It's our policy that our partners do not ask why those firearms are being stored. And I'm just grateful that our partners really have a respect for their customers and making sure that they're treated with dignity and privacy. And so, of course, that's built into our policies, but it's also the heart of our partners. And of course, you're going to have situations like, hey, I'm going to be deployed for a year and I want to make sure that I'm making payments up front or something like that. So if there's a scenario that, you know, they're describing what's going on, that might come up. But our partners are trained not to ask questions and even to push back a little bit and just say, look, whatever private reasons, I totally respect that. But logistically, let me know when you think you need to pick this up or how we can help you in the meantime. And so that's just, privacy is very important. And I also think it's important. It's interesting. You know, we do provide suicide prevention training for our partners and for range safety officers and firearms instructors. And I think there's it's very important to educate our community to be looking for warning signs. And certainly our partners do that. And within the provisions of running an FFL, there's already things built into what that entails. So for example, if someone comes in to a gun store and they smell like alcohol and they're crying and they're a mess, yes, at that moment, they might say, okay, let's talk about firearm storage if that's why that customer's there. But there's already regulations in place that an FFL has to, you know, like, all right, let's make sure that you're in the right mind while we're doing a transaction about firearms. So it certainly doesn't negate anything like that. It doesn't remove any of the requirements that the FFLs already have, but specifically asking about firearm storage and why they're not going to ask. And they might even say, this is, you know, hey, I'm not a counselor. And I don't necessarily need to hear about all the details, but I do care about you. And this is the part that I'm qualified to talk about. And I think that's something that, you know, over time with our how we've trained our FFL partners, we want to teach them to be compassionate, but also respect privacy and to be professional about it. So that's why people trust Hold My Guns. They know that they're going to be treated in a way that respects their rights and privacy.
You know, one of the other questions I had, you know, obviously, I mean, I'm a big fan of voluntary offsite storage programs. I think they do save lives. I think they are a much more appropriate alternative, both pragmatically and constitutionally speaking, to red flag laws. But in talking with a couple of FFLs who participate in these programs, I know that, you know, they can charge a fee. It's not supposed to be exorbitant, but it's supposed to, you know, cover the cost of storage. But, you know, storage is that's a finite amount of space you got, right? It's kind of contingent mm-hmm. on how big your footprint is in your store, how many safes you have. And that is an expense for FFLs who want to take part in these programs. Would you like to see either included in legislation going forward or maybe just as follow-up legislation, tax credits for FFLs who participate when it comes to, you know, buying gun safes for this program, grant money that could be available to FFLs to purchase gun safes? Because it seems to me like that may be one barrier to entry for FFLs that, hey, I want to do this, but, you know, I've got my inventory that I'm selling that I got to protect, and I just don't have a whole lot of extra room to take in other guns.
I think that's a great question, Cam. Personally, and as a leader of Hold My Guns, I'm very hesitant to ask for government funding for things, but I do believe in grants that are given by private donors and organizations to help support things like this. You know, with whenever there's government grants, that comes from taxpayers' dollars. So I just get nervous about that. I know that there are a lot of strings attached that can happen with some of those bills. And actually, in Ohio, one of the ways that I educated Senator Kaler on this bill, the original rendition of the bill had provisions in there that the attorney general is going to be monitoring the intake for the firearm storage. And that's actually what attracted me to saying something, because I was like, hey, this is interesting. Someone's talking about voluntary firearm storage. And I started to read the bill and I was like, oh no, like we do not want these records being sent to the attorney general's office. And so, yeah. You know, we all know that anytime the government gets involved, whether it's if it's through providing grants or if it's being involved with the programs, that they want to have their hand in that information. And, you know, in that particular case with the form that they were trying to propose that the attorney general would use, there was nothing in there to say that they couldn't add additional questions like, tell me why you're storing the firearm. Oh. So, you know, we just always have to be careful and really keep it when we're interacting with the government to a minimum. That being said, I think that, you know, if there are programs that are working with the state that are interested in donating things like safes or programs that have funds allocated for outreach or something like that, there's absolutely opportunities to come alongside of FFLs that are interested in offering the service. something that is really cool, although it's, you know, it's old news for at this point, but in 2023, the ATF actually took the process that Joshua Prince helped to develop, our attorney, and they sent it out to all FFLs and said any FFL can participate in voluntary firearm storage. So, you know, for me, that's just exciting again to see how this vision for it to be a normal part of services at a local gun shop, that's something that is truly now available for everyone. So I know that not everyone's going to be qualified to be a Hold My Guns partner or have that connection. But as those gun shops are thinking about providing that service, which again, now is open to all FFLs, to offer voluntary firearm storage, I know that there are many different programs across the United States that are interested in contributing to that. That being said, we do have a scholarship fund going. So if individuals who are looking for storage but are having trouble with affording it, for example, if someone's going into a shelter or something like that, they should reach out and we can help to provide some scholarship for firearm storage. And we are also working with some safe companies to get some extra firearm safes for our partners. So I'm excited that those things are in the works. The way that I designed Hold My Guns were behind the counter storage. The reason why that was so important to me to have a process for behind the counter is that even a small shop can store a firearm or two, and especially in rural areas where there aren't necessarily larger stores and there's just a neighborhood gun shop, to even have a place in the safe for one or two firearms would make a difference in a small community. So on one hand, you're right. It can be a barrier if a store doesn't have a place for a lot of firearms, but even if they have a place for one or two, that can save lives.
Absolutely. Well, again, I'm so thrilled to see what's going on in Ohio and other states around the country. I'm really excited about the refresh for the website. And you know, one of the things I noted when I was at the website is this is very much geared towards FFL. So, you know, if you're a gun owner and you want to see your local gun shop participate, I don't see any reason why you shouldn't refer them to Hold My Gun. Say, hey, check out this website when you have the chance. And let these FFLs see for themselves how this works, how this operates, the success stories, because a lot of this still really is word of mouth. I mean, there are a lot of us in the Second Amendment community who know about Hold My Guns, who know about voluntary offsite storage. There's still a lot of folks who don't. And, you know, the ATF sent out that guidance. I'd like to think that that guidance gets read, but who knows how many people just kind of skimmed it, threw it in the trash. Who knows how many FFLs we've had since 2023. So we as gun owners, I think, need to be evangelical about programs like Hold My Guns and make sure that our local gun sellers are aware that this is an option. And this is something that a service that, you know, we'd like to see in our community.
One of the things that was important to me for our website refresh was to provide resources that people can better share that message. So if you look on the resource page, we have four resources up. The first one, of course, is our safety plan that equips gun owners to be in the driver's seat and not along for the ride if they're ever in a crisis situation. It helps them to plan ahead, much like you would have a will, and thinking along those lines that your wishes are honored. And so in a crisis situation, if you have directives for what you want done with your firearms, as well as the people that you want to involve as your support team, that can really make a difference to help preserve rights in a time of crisis. The key is to be thinking ahead and to have a plan so that you're not just going into an emergency without a plan. It's the same kind of thing that we apply with firearms training and situational awareness. It helps people to take stock of what's going on in their own lives and to have a safety plan and one that involves what to do with firearms. So that is on the resource page. And we also have three brochures. One is for FFLs who are interested in getting involved. One is for gun owners to help to educate them more about the program and what to expect. And then there's also a brochure for people who want to refer friends to hold my guns. And it might not just be friends. It might be veterans organizations or first responders, real estate agents. There's a whole list of suggestions in that brochure, but we really wanted to equip people to be able to share the message in a real way with people they care about, and to do it in a way that is respectful. So please take a look at those. They should be available to download, and it's something that people can share with those who need to hear this message.
Sarah, again, thank you for all of your advocacy. Thank you for the hard work that you're putting in. Again, I hope my guns are saving lives. It is helping gun owners across the country. I'm looking forward to seeing it just grow bigger and better as the years continue. But I want to thank you so much for coming on the program today.
Thank you, Cam. I really appreciate this opportunity to share about our mission. I would encourage people to go to holdmyguns.org and check out the new website. Check out our socials at holdmyguns.org. You'll be seeing our refresh there shortly. And we're just excited to move into this next chapter with our work.
Sarah Joy Albrecht with Hold My Guns. Thanks so much for being a part of the program today. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks, Cam.
My thanks to Sarah Joy for joining us on the program once again. Heck of a time to come down with bronchitis, by the way, when you're sitting in on a coast-to-coast national morning show. Not a great time, but apologies for the scratchy throat here. Before we get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, our recidivist report, a couple of other legislative updates for you. So I just heard from Kose Ono, head of Virgin Islands Safe Gun Owners, that Governor Albert Bryant has signed that sweeping gun control bill into law. This is meant to, in some ways, address the DOJ's lawsuit against the Virgin Islands. It, however, also creates a lot of problems for the Virgin Islands in terms of respecting our right to keep and bear arms. So I anticipate that the DOJ is going to be amending its complaint here in the very near future. And I have a piece of it bearing arms today. I hope that when they are examining the laws that are in place, you know, President Donald Trump on Tuesday talked about his support for national right to carry reciprocity. I think it has a very tough road in Congress right now. H.R. 38 has been on the union calendar, meaning it can be brought to the floor for a vote at any time since last October. And the fact that it hasn't been brought up for a vote tells me that the votes aren't there in the House. You certainly don't have 60 votes in the Senate. So as long as the filibuster is in place, you need to be able to invoke cloture. You need 60 votes. You don't have it. But I think that there is perhaps a way for the Trump administration to use the judicial branch to try to advance the cause of right to carry reciprocity. And that is through the work of the DOJ Civil Rights Division. So in the Virgin Islands, there really is no reciprocity with other states. And there's an open question about whether or not non-residents could actually get a Virgin Islands license to carry. Kose Ono actually is in a lawsuit right now because he had a concealed carry license issued by the Virgin Islands. When he tried to renew that license, he was told he could not unless he had a U.S. Virgin Islands driver's license. Which, of course, non-residents don't have, right? Non-residents are supposed to be able to apply to the Virgin Islands Police Department for essentially individual reciprocity. Like, we'll recognize your carry permit for a period of 90 days. The link to apply or learn more information about this on the Virgin Islands PD's website is apparently broken. I can't get access to it. So I'm not sure that there really is a way for non-residents of the Virgin Islands to exercise their right to carry while they're there in the U.S. territory. Certainly not an easy way. And just seems to me like, you know, I haven't run this by Harmeet Dhillon, haven't run this by Barry Arrington, who's the head of the Second Amendment section, but if they are going to be amending this complaint against the Virgin Islands government and the Virgin Islands Police Department, it seems to me like this would be a pretty good opportunity to raise the issue of the difficulties or the impossibility of lawfully carrying in the Virgin Islands if you are not a resident of the Virgin Islands. And maybe that's a way we can work towards national right to carry reciprocity, even if the votes aren't there in Congress right now. I also want to mention that in Virginia, we've got some unusual circumstances here. So the Democrats have apparently agreed to a budget before the June 30th deadline. But Governor Abigail Spanberger says, I want some amendments here. So the legislature is going back into session next Monday. The governor has, I believe, until Monday at 11:59 p.m. to sign a budget into law. One of the things, though, that will be changing is the language of Virginia's assault firearms and large capacity magazine ban. As of this recording, we don't know what those changes are, but we do know that the governor's office has informed the sponsors of the legislation that she wants some amendments here. This is pretty unheard of. I mean, the bill was passed. The bill was signed. The bill goes into effect next Wednesday. It is subject to, again, four state-level challenges, I believe two federal challenges. And it is likely that these changes are, like the Virgin Islands gun control bill, meant to moot or at least make that litigation more difficult. I don't think it can moot it entirely because the question is, can you ban commonly owned firearms? And even if the Fourth Circuit, which controls Virginia federally, says, sure, because they're not protected by the Second Amendment, anyway, because they're light machine guns. The challenges under the state constitution of Virginia don't have to depend on the Fourth Circuit's jurisprudence. And again, I don't think there's any way to put enough lips on this pig so that it's not a ban on commonly owned arms. So I don't know what the nature of these amendments are going to look like. I have heard rumors, but nothing that I am comfortable reporting at this point. But keep your eyes out, because this language is likely to change again before July 1st. And keep in mind, Governor Spanberger did propose an amended version of the gun and magazine ban. She wanted to exempt a couple of shotguns that were on the list because she said, well, I mean, they're used for hunting. But she also wanted to expand the definition of an assault firearm to include any centerfire rifle that is equipped with a 15 magazine that can hold more than 15 rounds. It wasn't a centerfire. I said centerfire rifle. I meant to say centerfire fire because it would have encompassed any semi-automatic handgun with a detachable magazine that could hold more than 15 rounds. And while the ban on assault firearms is a ban on the sale, manufacture, and transfer, there's a separate law going into effect on July the 1st that bans the carrying of an assault firearm in most public places, including public roadways and sidewalks. So now all of a sudden, if Governor Spanberger had gotten her way, carrying a pistol with a standard 17-round magazine would be a crime in Virginia. I don't know that language is going to be part of the governor's proposed amendments to the budget, but keep your eyes out, because it wouldn't surprise me if she tries to take one more crack at this before the law goes into effect on July 1. All right. Now, on to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with a bizarre story out of Lawrence, Kansas. Repeat felon who is granted a deal and then secrecy is charged with another felony before sentencing in previous case. Yeah. Anytime I see plea deal and secrecy, my spidey senses start tingling here. Michael Pope, most recently charged with felony theft, which stems from a May 4th incident in which he allegedly stole silverware from an individual that was valued at more than $1,500. Michael Pope also was charged with aggravated attempted robbery and aggravated assault for an incident early last year in which he allegedly donned a mask and aggressively demanded money from a person at Buddy's Liquor in Lawrence, Kansas, while brandishing a firearm. There's another case in December 2024 when he was accused of felony theft of a bicycle worth more than $1,500. So Pope ended up pleading guilty to aggravated assault. The other felony charges in those two cases were dismissed as part of the deal. The state agreed that there would be no finding that a gun was used during the crime, which allowed Pope to evade a law that presumes a prison sentence if a defendant uses a gun while committing a personal felony. The state also did not object to Pope's GPS monitor being removed in the months before he was sentenced. Sentence, by the way, still hasn't taken place. And said that it would recommend that Pope be given probation despite his lengthy criminal history. Now, according to the Kansas Department of Corrections, Pope has convictions for theft and burglary in Osage County in 2012, forgery in Anderson County in 2003, burglary, aggravated assault in Shawnee County in 2012 and 2013, robbery in Franklin County in 2013, robbery in Douglas County in 2006. He was most recently discharged from the Kansas penal system in May of 2024. So why did he get that deal in Lawrence, Kansas? And is that deal off the table now that he's accused of another felony? His next court hearing is scheduled for July 7th. That's when the next steps in these cases will be scheduled. But there's no word on when his actual sentencing for the aggravated robbery will take place, even though he entered into a plea deal months ago. I got to say, this is again, just a bizarre story from the Lawrence Journal World. And I don't know why the state seems to be going out of its way to make sure that William Michael Pope, does not go to prison for a violent felony, even though it was not his first runaround. It is, again, very, very odd. Very odd. Today's armed citizen story, not as odd. We see these stories on a fairly regular basis. Headline: alleged burglar in critical condition after being shot by a tenant. Yep, picked the wrong house to try to burgle. This was in Memphis, Tennessee. Officers with the Memphis Police Department responded to a burglary call about 3:15 Tuesday afternoon in the northeast part of the city. Once they were on the scene, they attempted to make contact with the suspect, but the suspect fled, according to police documents. The tenant told police that he got home just after 3 o'clock that afternoon to find somebody inside his home. He saw a man who was wearing a ski mask attempting to take a TV off the wall. Tenant told police that the alleged burglar reached inside a black bag in an attempt to pull something out, which is when the tenant pulled a gun and shot the man twice. The burglar then ran through the apartment, ran out the back door, but not before the resident fired his gun several more times. Police documents say that the suspect fell and dropped the black bag, then got up and kept running towards the apartment complex. The injured man was apprehended a couple of blocks away. He was taken to a local hospital in critical condition. No identity has been released at this point in time, but all indications are, again, this was an act of self-defense on the part of the tenant. We'll keep our eyes open for any more details, but that's the latest that we have out of Memphis. And finally today, our good deed of the day: in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A man in Massachusetts who helped save a driver after their SUV rolled over in some floodwaters. Massachusetts State Police said troopers from the Dartmouth Barracks responded to a single vehicle crash just before 6:30 Tuesday morning. There was a pretty severe flooding in the New Bedford area. Stephen St. Martin said he was driving to work. He saw the SUV hydroplane, lose control, and then flip over into the floodwater. He said, "I pulled up. I jumped out of my vehicle." He said he tried to get to the passenger side door, but the doors were locked. And then he tried punching through the glass, but he couldn't break through. He eventually worked his way to the back of the SUV. He was able to open up the tailgate and then go in through the back of the vehicle. He said he was able to help the driver stand up, get him out, clean him up from an airbag burn, carried him through the water to the highway. The driver, believed to be in their early 30s, escaped with minor injuries. St. Martin posted a photo on Facebook showing the SUV upside down in a marsh with the back trunk open. And he said in the caption, "To the driver I pulled out of the car on 140 that was underwater, you have no idea how much it made my day to see you alive and okay. I didn't catch your name, but I'm glad you're okay." When St. Martin spoke to the local press, he said the driver was scared. He said, especially the fact that below the door panel, his head was under. So that area was underwater and the water was coming up fast. St. Martin said that he normally wouldn't have even been on the road that time of day, but he left for work early. He said, "You know, everything happens for some reason. He said, I'm usually there at the right place at the right time. Well, that was certainly the case Tuesday morning. And thanks to Stephen St. Martin, the driver of this vehicle, alive and well today. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. And I want to thank you for being a part of the program, as always. Tomorrow, we've got another opinion day of the Supreme Court, so it is entirely possible that we will have the decision of Wolford versus Lopez handed down. We are scheduled to talk about the Hamani case on tomorrow's program. What does the Hamani ruling mean for individuals who have a medical marijuana license, for example? Individuals who live in a state where marijuana has been legalized for recreational use. We know that the Hamani decision was an as-applied challenge to Daniel Ali Hamani. But will we see legislatures around the country change the law to conform with Hamani? And in the meantime, what happens if you are, again, not a danger to yourself or others when you consume marijuana? Maybe you're using it to alleviate the side effects of chemotherapy or something like that. How much legal jeopardy are you in if you do so while exercising your Second Amendment rights? We'll talk about that again on Thursday's Cam and Company. I will also be filling in for Larry O'Connor once again tomorrow on O'Connor and Company. So if you are around behind the wheel, have access to a radio or the Salem News Channel between 6 a.m. and 9 a.m. Eastern, be sure to check it out. In the meantime, have a great rest of your Hump Day Wednesday. Appreciate you being with us today. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, be free.